with a ping and bounced off into the hearth. Ian went on sneezing in a fusillade of hapless snorts and explosions, but Jamie and I were both on our knees, scrabbling in the ashes, heedless of filth. "I've got it, I think," I added, sitting back on my heels and peering at the handful of ashes I held, in the midst of which was a small, round, dust-covered object. "Aye, that's it." Jamie seized my neglected forceps from the table, plucked the object delicately from my hand, and dropped it into my glass of water. A delicate plume of ash and soot floated up through the water to form a dusty grey film on the surface. Below, the object glittered up at us, serene and glowing, its beauty at last revealed. A faceted, clear stone, the colour of golden cherry, half the size of my thumbnail.
"Chrysoberyl,"
Jamie said softly, a hand on my back. He looked at Mandy's basket, the silky black curls lifting gently in the breeze.
"Do you think it will serve?"
Ian, still wheezing and watery-eyed and with a red-stained handkerchief pressed to his much-abused proboscis, came to look over my other shoulder.
"Halfway, is it?" he said in tones of deep satisfaction.
"Huh.
Wherever did you get that?
Or rather," I corrected myself, "who did you steal it from?"
"Neil Forbes."
Jamie picked the gem up, turning it gently over in his fingers.
"There were a good deal more of the Chowder Society than there were of us, so we ran down the street and round the corner, down between the warehouses there. I kent Forbes's place, aye, because I'd been there before,"
Ian put in. One of Mandy's feet was sticking up out of the basket. He touched the sole of it with a fingertip and smiled to see her toes extend in reflex.
"There was a great hole in the back where someone had broken down the wall, just covered over with a sheet of canvas, nailed it over it, like. So we pulled it loose and ducked inside."
Where they had found themselves, standing next to the small enclosed space Forbes used for an office, and, for the moment, deserted.
"I was sitting in a bitty wee box on the desk," Ian said, coming to look proprietorially at the chrysoberyl. "Just sitting there. I just picked it up to look at when we heard the watchman coming, so..."
He shrugged and smiled at me, happiness momentarily transforming his homely features.
"And you think the watchman won't tell him you were there?" I asked sceptically. "The two of them could scarcely be more conspicuous." "Oh, I imagine he will."
Jamie bent over Mandy's basket, holding the chrysoberyl between thumb and forefinger.
"Look what Grandad and Uncle Ian have brought ye, a weirin'," he said softly. "We decided that it was a small enough ransom to pay for what he did to Brianna," Ian said, sobering somewhat. "I expect Mr. Forbes may feel it reasonable too. And if not..."
He smiled again, though not with happiness, and put his hand to his knife.
"He's got another ear, after all."
Very slowly, a tiny fist rose through the netting, fingers flexing as they grasped at the stone.
"Is she still asleep?" I whispered.
Jamie nodded and gently withdrew the stone.
On the far side of the table, the fish stared austerely at the ceiling, ignoring everything.
Chapter 116. The Ninth Earl of Ellesmere. July the 9th, 1776.
"The water won't be cold."
She'd spoken automatically without thinking.
"I shouldn't think that will matter much."
A nerve jumped in Roger's cheek, and he turned away abruptly. She reached out, touching him delicately, as though he were a bomb that might explode if jarred. He glanced at her, hesitated, then took the hand she offered him with a small, crooked smile.
"Sorry," he said.
"I'm sorry, too," she said softly. They stood close together, fingers knotted, watching the tide recede across the narrow beach, a fraction of an inch uncovered with each lap of the tiny waves. The flats were grey and bleak in the evening light, pebble-strewn and rust-stained from the peaty waters of the river. With the tide going out, the harbour water was brown and feculent, the stain reaching past the ships at anchor, nearly to the open sea. When it turned, the clear grey water of the ocean would flow in, sweeping up the Cape Fear, obliterating the mudflats and everything on them. "Over there," she said, still softly, though there was no one near enough to hear them. She tilted her head, indicating a group of weathered mooring posts driven deep into the mud. A skiff was tied to one, two of the Perettas, the four-oared dragonflies that plied the harbour, to another.
"You're sure?"
He shifted his weight, glancing up and down the shore. The narrow beach fell away into cold pebbles, exposed and gleaming with the leaving of the tide. Small crabs skittered hastily among them, not to waste a moment's gleaning.
"I'm sure. People in the Blue Boar were talking about it. A traveller asked where, and Mrs. Smoots said it was the old mooring posts near the warehouses."
A torn flounder lay dead among the rocks, white flesh washed clean and bloodless. The small, busy claws picked and shredded. Tiny maws gaped and gulped, pinching at morsels. She felt her gorge rise at the sight and swallowed hard. It wouldn't matter what came after, she knew that. But still... Roger nodded absently, his eyes narrowed against the harbour wind, calculating distances.
"There'll be quite a crowd, I expect."
There already was one. The turn of the tide wouldn't be for an hour or more, but people were drifting down to the harbour in twos and threes and fours, standing in the lee of the chandlery to smoke their pipes, sitting on the barrels of salt fish to talk and gesture. Mrs. Smoots had been right. Several were pointing out the mooring posts to their less knowledgeable companions. Roger shook his head.
"It'll have to be from that side. The best view is from there."
He nodded across the inner arc of the harbour toward the three ships that rocked at the main quay.
"From one of the ships? What do you think?"
Priyana fumbled in the pocket tied at her waist and pulled out her small brass telescope. She frowned in concentration, lips pursed as she surveyed the ships. A fishing ketch, Mr. Chester's brig, and a larger ship, part of the British fleet that had come in the early afternoon.
"Whoa, Nelly," she murmured,
arresting the sweep of her gaze as the pale blotch of her head filled the lens.
"Is that who I think? Hot dog it is!"
A tiny flame of delight flared in her bosom, warming her.
"Is who?"
Roger squinted, straining to see unaided.
"It's John. Lord John."
"Lord John Grey? You sure?"
"Yes. On the brig. He must have come down from Virginia. Whoops, he's gone now. But he's there. I saw him."
She turned to Roger, excited, folding her telescope as she gripped him by the arm.
"Come on, let's go and find him. He'll help."
Roger followed, though with considerable less enthusiasm.
"You're going to tell him? Do you think that's wise?"
"No, but it doesn't matter. He knows me."
Roger looked sharply at her, but the dark look on his face thawed into a reluctant smile.
"You mean he knows better than to try stopping you doing whatever you've made up your bloody-minded mind to do?"
She smiled back at him, thanking him with her eyes. He didn't like it. In fact, he hated it. And she didn't blame him. But he wouldn't try to stop her, either. He knew her, too.
"Yes! Come on, before he disappears!"
It was a slow slog round the curve of the harbour, pushing through the knots of gathering sightseers. Outside the breakers, the crowd grew abruptly thicker. A cluster of red-coated soldiers stood and sat in disarray on the pavement, sea bags and chests scattered round them, their number too great to fit inside the tavern. Ale pots and pints of cider were being passed from hand to hand from the interior of the public house, slopping freely on the heads of those over whom they passed. A sergeant, harassed but competent, was leaning against the timbered wall of the inn, riffling through a sheaf of papers, issuing orders, and eating a meat pie simultaneously. Brianna wrinkled her nose as they stepped carefully through the obstacle course of scattered men and luggage. A reek of seasickness and unclean flesh rose from the serried ranks. A few onlookers muttered under their breath at sight of the soldiers. Several more cheered and waved as they passed, to receive genial shouts in return. Newly liberated from the bowels of the scorpion, the soldiers were too thrilled with their freedom and the taste of fresh food and drink to care who did or said anything whatever. Roger stepped in front of her, thrusting away through the crowd with shoulders and elbows. Appreciative shouts and whistles rose from the soldiers as they saw her, but she kept her head down, eyes fixed on Roger's feet as he shoved ahead. She heaved a sigh of relief as they emerged from the press at the head of the quay. The soldiers' equipment was being unloaded from the Scorpion at the far side of the dock, but there was little foot traffic near the brig. She paused, looking to and fro for a glimpse of Lord John's distinctive, fair head. "There he is." Roger tugged at her arm, and she swung in the direction he was pointing, only to collide heavily with him as he stepped abruptly back. "What?" she began crossly, but then stopped, feeling as though she had been punched in the chest.
"Who in God's holy name is that?"
Roger spoke softly, echoing her thoughts. Lord John Grey stood near the far end of the quay, in animated conversation with one of the red-coated soldiers. An officer, gold braid gleamed on his shoulder, and he carried a laced tricorn beneath one arm. It wasn't the man's uniform that caught her attention, though.
"Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ," she whispered,
feeling numb around the lips. He was tall, very tall, with a breadth of shoulder and a stretch of white-stockinged calf that were attracting admiring glances from a cluster of oyster girls. It was something more than height or build that made goose flesh ripple down the length of her spine, though. It was the fact of his carriage, his outline, a cock of the head, and an air of physical self-confidence that drew eyes like a magnet.
"It's Dar," she said, knowing even as she spoke that this was ridiculous.
Even had Jamie Fraser, for some unimaginable reason, chosen to disguise himself in a soldier's uniform and come down to the docks, this man was different.
As he turned to look at something across the harbour, she saw that he was different, lean, like her father, and muscular, but still with the slenderness of boyishness. Graceful, like Jamie, but with the slight hesitancy of teenaged awkwardness not long past. He turned further, backlit by the glow of light off the water, and she felt her knees go weak. A long, straight nose rising to a high forehead, the sudden curve of a broad Viking cheekbone. Roger gripped her tightly by the arm, but his attention was as riveted on the young man as hers was.
"I will be damned," he said.
She gulped air, trying to get enough breath.
"You and me both. And him."
"Him?"
"Him, him, and him."
Lord John, the mysterious young soldier, and most of all, her father.
"Come on."
She pulled free and strode down the quay, feeling oddly disembodied, as though she watched herself from a distance. It was like watching herself come toward a funhouse mirror, seeing herself, her face, her height, her gestures, suddenly transposed inside a red coat and doeskin breeches. His hair was dark chestnut brown, not red, but it was thick like hers, with the same slight wave to it, the same cowlick that lifted it off his brow. Lord John turned his head slightly and caught sight of her. His eyes bulged, and a look of absolute horror blanched his features. He made a feeble flapping motion with one hand, trying to stop her coming nearer,
but he might as well have tried to stop the Cornish Express.
"Hello there," she said brightly. "Fancy meeting you here, Lord John."
Lord John made a faint quacking noise like a stepped-on duck, but she wasn't paying attention. The young man turned to face her, smiling cordially.
Holy God, he had her father's eyes, too.
Dark-lashed and so young, the skin near them was fresh and clear, completely unlined. But the same slanted blue Fraser cat eyes, just like hers. Her heart was hammering so hard in her chest, she was sure they could hear it. The young man seemed to find nothing amiss, though. He bowed to her, smiling, but very correct.
"Your servant, ma'am," he said.
He glanced at Lord John, plainly expecting an introduction.
Lord John pulled himself together with an obvious effort and made her a leg. "My dear, how delightful to encounter you again. I had no idea."
"Yeah, I bet you didn't," she thought, but went on smiling pleasantly. She could feel Roger beside her, nodding and saying something in response to his lordship's greeting, trying his best not to stare.
"My son," Lord John was saying, "William, Lord Ellesmere."
He eyed her narrowly as though daring her to say anything.
"Might I present Mr. Roger Mackenzie, William? And his wife?"
"Sir, Mrs. Mackenzie." The young man took her hand before she realized what he meant to do, and bowed low over it, planting a small formal kiss upon her knuckles. She nearly gasped at the unexpected touch of his breath on her skin, but instead gripped his hand much harder than she'd meant to. He looked momentarily disconcerted, but extricated himself with reasonable grace. He was much younger than she'd thought at first glance. It was the uniform and the air of self-possession that made him seem older. He was looking at her with a slight frown on his clear-cut features, as though trying to place her.
"I think," he began, hesitant. "Have we met Mrs. Mackenzie?"
"No," she said, astonished to hear her voice emerge sounding normal. "No, I'm afraid not. I would have remembered." She darted a dagger-like glance at Lord John, who had gone slightly green around the gills.
Lord John had been a soldier too, though. He pulled himself together with a visible effort, putting a hand on William's arm. "You'd best go and see to your men, William," he said. "Shall we dine together later?"
"I'm engaged to the Colonel for supper, Father," William said.
"But I am sure he wouldn't object. Was you to join us?" "It may be quite late, though," he added.
"I understand there is to be an execution in the morning, and my troops are asked to be at the ready in case of disturbance in the town. It will take some time to settle and organize everything."
"Disturbance?"
Lord John was eyeing her over William's shoulder.
"Is a disturbance expected, then?"
William shrugged.
"I cannot say, Papa. Apparently it's not a political matter, though, but only a pirate. I shouldn't think there would be any trouble." "These days everything is a political matter, Willie," his father said rather sharply. "Never forget that. And it is always wiser to expect trouble than to meet it unprepared."
The young man flushed slightly, but kept his countenance.
"Quite," he said, in clipped tones. "I'm sure you have a familiarity with the local conditions, which I lack. I'm obliged to you for your advice, Father."
He relaxed slightly and turned to bow to Brianna.
"Pleased to have your acquaintance, Mrs. Mackenzie." "Your servant, sir."
He nodded to Roger, turned and strode off down the quay, adjusting his tricorne to the proper angle of authority. Brianna inhaled deeply, hoping that by the time she let her breath out, she would have words to go with it. Lord John beat her to it.
"Yes," he said simply. "Of course he is."
Amid the logjam of thoughts, reactions, and emotions that clogged her brain, she seized on the one that seemed momentarily most important.
"Does my mother know?"
"Does Jamie know?"
Roger asked at the same instant. She looked at him in surprise, and he raised one eyebrow at her.
Yes, a man could certainly father a child without realizing it.
He had.
Lord John sighed. With William's departure, he had relaxed somewhat, and the natural colour was coming back to his face. He had been a soldier long enough to recognise the inevitable when he saw it.
They both know, yes.
How old is he?
Roger asked abruptly. Lord John shot him a sharp glance.
18.
And to save your counting backward, it was 1758 in a place called Hellwater in the Lake District.
Brianna took another breath, finding this one came a little easier.
Okay, so it was before my mother came back.
Yes, from France, supposedly. Where I gather you were born and raised.
He gave her a gimlet look. He knew she spoke no more than bastard French. She could feel the blood rushing to her face.
This is no time for secrets, she said. If you want to know about my mother and me, I'll tell you, but you're going to tell me about him.
She jerked her head angrily backward toward the tavern. About my brother. Lord John pursed his lips, regarding her through narrowed eyes as he thought. Finally, he nodded.
I see no help for it. One thing, though. Are your parents here, in Wilmington?
Yes, in fact. She looked upward, trying to make out the position of the sun through the thin coastal haze. It hung just above the horizon, a disk of burning gold. We were going to meet them for supper.
Here?
Yes.
Lord John swung round to Roger.
Mr. Mackenzie, you will very much oblige me, sir, if you will go at once to find your father-in-law and apprise him of the presence of the 9th Earl of Ellesmere. Tell him that I trust his good judgment will dictate an immediate removal from Wilmington upon receipt of this news.
Roger stared at him for a moment, brows quirked in interest.
The Earl of Ellesmere? How the hell did he manage that?
Lord John had recovered all his natural colour and a bit more. He was distinctly pink in the face.
Never mind. Will you go? Jamie must leave the town at once, before they meet by inadvertence, or before someone sees the two of them separately and begins to speculate aloud.
I doubt Jamie will leave, Roger said, looking at Lord John with a certain degree of speculation himself.
Not before tomorrow, in any case.
Why not? Lord John demanded, looking from one to the other. Why are you all here in the first place? It isn't the ex...
Oh, good Lord, don't tell me.
He clapped a hand to his face and dragged it slowly down, glaring through his fingers with the expression of a man tried beyond bearing. Brianna bit her lower lip. When she spotted Lord John, she had been not only pleased, but relieved of a small bit of her burden of worry, counting on him to help in her plan. With this new complication, though, she felt torn in too, unable to cope with either situation, or even to think about them coherently. She looked over at Roger, seeking advice. He met her eyes in one of those long, unspoken marital exchanges. Then he nodded, making the decision for her.
I'll go find Jamie. You have a bit of a chat with his lordship, eh?
He bent and kissed her hard, then turned and strode away down the dock, walking in a way that made people draw unconsciously aside, avoiding the touch of his garments. Lord John had closed his eyes and appeared to be praying, presumably for strength. She gripped him by the arm and his eyes sprang open, startled as though he'd been bitten by a horse.
"Is it as striking as I think?" she said. "Him and me." The word felt funny on her tongue. "Him."
Lord John looked at her, fair brow furrowed in troubled concentration as he searched her face, feature by feature.
"I think so," he said slowly. "To me, certainly. To a casual observer, perhaps much less so. There is the difference of colouring, to be sure." And of sex. His uniform. But, my dear, you know that your own appearance is so striking.
So freakish, he meant. She sighed, taking his meaning.
"People stare at me anyway," she finished for him. She pulled down the brim of her hat, drawing it far enough forward to hide not only hair, but face as well, and glowered at him from its shadow.
"Then we better go where no one who knows him will see me, hadn't we?"
The quay and the market streets were thronged. Every public house in town, and not a few private ones, would soon be full of quartered soldiers. Her father and Jem were with Alexander Lillington, her mother and Mandy at Dr. Fentiman's, both places centres of business and gossip, and she had declared that she possessed no intention of going near either parent in any case, not until she knew all there was to know. Lord John thought that might be rather more than he was himself prepared to tell her, but this wasn't a time for quibbles. Still, the exigencies of privacy left them a choice of graveyard or the deserted racetrack, and Brianna said, a marked edge in her voice, that under the circumstances she wanted no heavy-handed reminders of mortality.
"These mortal circumstances," he said carefully, leading her around a large puddle. "You refer to tomorrow's execution. It is Stephen Bonnet, I collect."
"Yes," she said, distracted.
"That can wait, though. You aren't engaged for supper, are you?"
"No, but..."
"William," she said, eyes on her shoes as they paced slowly round the sandy oval.
"William, 9th Earl of Ellesmere, you said?"
"William Clarence Henry George," Lord John agreed. "Viscount Ashness, Master of Hellwater, Baron Derwent, and, yes, 9th Earl of Ellesmere."
She pursed her lips. "Which would sort of indicate that the world at large thinks his father is somebody else. Not Jamie Fraser, I mean."
"Was somebody else," he corrected. "One Ludovic, 8th Earl of Ellesmere, to be precise. I understand that the 8th Earl, unfortunately, died on the day his heir was born."
"Died of what? Shock?"
She was clearly in a dangerous mood. He was interested to note both her father's manner of controlled ferocity and her mother's sharp tongue at work. The combination was both fascinating and alarming. He hadn't any intention of allowing her to run this interview on her own terms, though.
"Gunshot," he said, with affected cheerfulness. "Your father shot him."
She made a small choking noise and stopped dead.
"That is not, by the way, common knowledge," he said, affecting not to notice her reaction. "The coroner's court returned a verdict of death by misadventure, which was not incorrect, I believe."
"Not incorrect," she murmured, sounding a trifle dazed. "I guess being shot is pretty misadventurous, all right."
"Of course there was talk," he said, offhanded, taking her arm and urging her forward again. "But the only witness, aside from William's grandparents, was an Irish coachman who was rather quickly pensioned off to County Sligo following the incident. The child's mother having also died that day, gossip was inclined to consider his lordship's death as..."
"His mother's dead too?"
She didn't stop this time, but turned to give him a penetrating glance from those deep blue eyes. Lord John had had sufficient practice in withstanding Fraser catlooks, though, and was not discomposed. "Her name was Geneva Dunsany. She died shortly after William's birth, of an entirely natural hemorrhage," he assured her.
"Entirely natural," she muttered half under her breath. She shot him another look. "This Geneva, she was married to the Earl? When she and,
The words seemed to stick in her throat. He could see doubt and repugnance struggling with her memories of William's undeniable face, and her knowledge of her father's character.
"He has not told me, and I would in no circumstance ask him," he said firmly.
She gave him another of those looks, which he returned with interest.
"Whatever the nature of Jamie's relations with Geneva Dunsany, I cannot conceive of his committing an act of such dishonour
as to deceive another man in his marriage. She relaxed fractionally, though her grip on his arm remained.
Neither can I, she said, rather grudgingly. But...
her lips compressed, relaxed.
Was he in love with her, do you think? She blurted.
What startled him wasn't the question, but the realization that it had never once occurred to him to ask it. Certainly not of Jamie, but not even of himself.
Why not? He wondered. He had no right to jealousy, and if he was fool enough to suffer it, it would have been considerably ex post facto in the case of Geneva Dunsany. He had had no inkling of William's origins until several years after the girl's death.
I have no idea, he said shortly.
Brianna's fingers drummed restlessly on his arm. She would have pulled free, but he put a hand on hers to still her.
Damn, she muttered, but ceased fidgeting and walked on, matching the length of his shorter stride. Weeds had sprung up in the oval, were sprouting through the sands of the track. She kicked at a clump of wild rye grass, sending a spray of dry seeds flying.
If they were in love, why didn't he marry her? She asked at last.
He laughed in sheer incredulity at the notion.
Marry her? My dear girl, he was the family groom.
A look of puzzlement flashed in her eye. He would have sworn that if she had spoken, the word would have been, so?
Where in the name of God were you raised? He demanded, stopping dead.
He could see things moving in her eyes. She had Jamie's trick of keeping her face a mask, but her mother's transparency still shone from within. He saw the decision in her eyes a moment before the slow smile touched her lips.
Boston, she said. I'm an American. But you knew I was a barbarian already, didn't you?
He grunted in response.
That does go some distance toward explaining your remarkably republican attitudes, he replied very dryly. Though I would strongly suggest that you disguise these dangerous sentiments for the sake of your family. Your father is in sufficient trouble on his own account. However, you may accept my assurance that it would not be possible for the daughter of a baronet to marry a groom, no matter how exigent the nature of their emotions.
Her turn to grunt at that, a highly expressive if totally unfeminine sound. He sighed and took her hand again, tucking it in the curve of his elbow for safekeeping.
He was a paroled prisoner, too, a Jacobite, a traitor. Believe me, marriage would not have occurred to either of them.
The damp air was misting on her skin, clinging to the down hairs on her cheeks. But that was in another country, she quoted softly. And besides, the wench is dead.
Very true, he said quietly.
They scuffed silently through the damp sand for a few moments, each alone in thought. At last, Brianna heaved a sigh, deep enough that he felt as well as heard it.
Well, she's dead anyway, and the Earl.
Do you know why Dar killed him? Did he tell you that?
Your father has never spoken of the matter, of Geneva, of the Earl, or even directly of William's parentage, to me.
He spoke precisely, eyes fixed on a pair of gulls, probing the sand near a clump of sawgrass.
But I know, yes.
He glanced at her.
William is my son, after all, in the sense of common usage, at least.
In a great deal more than that, but that wasn't a matter he chose to discuss with Jamie's daughter.
Her eyebrows rose. Yes. How did that happen?
As I told you, both of William's parents, his putative parents, died on the day of his birth. His father, the Earl, I mean, had no close kin, so the boy was left to the guardianship of his grandfather, Lord Dunsany. Geneva's sister, Isabel, became William's mother in all but fact. And I?
He shrugged, nonchalant.
I married Isabel. I became William's guardian with Dunsany's consent, and he has regarded me as his stepfather since he was 6 years old. He is my son.
You? You married?
She was goggling down at him with an air of incredulity that he found offensive. You have the most peculiar notions concerning marriage, he said crossly. It was an eminently suitable match.
One red eyebrow went up in a gesture that was Jamie to the life.
Did your wife think so?
She asked, in an uncanny echo of her mother's voice asking the same question.
When her mother had asked it, he had been nonplussed. This time, he was prepared.
That, he said tersely, was in another country. And Isabel?
As he had hoped, that silenced her.
A fire was burning at the far end of the sandy oval where travellers had made a rough camp. People come down river to see the execution, he wondered. Men seeking to enlist in the rebel militias.
A figure moved, dimly seen through the haze of smoke, and he turned, leading Brianna back along the way they had come.
This conversation was sufficiently awkward without the risk of interruption.
You asked about Ellesmere, he said, taking control of the conversation once more. The story given to the coroner's court by Lord Dunsany was that Ellesmere had been showing him a new pistol, which discharged by accident. It was the sort of story that is told in order to be disbelieved, giving the impression that in reality the Earl had shot himself, doubtless from grief at the death of his wife, but that the Dunsanys wished to avoid the stigma of suicide for the sake of the child. The coroner naturally perceived both the falsity of the story and the wisdom of allowing it to stand.
"That's not what I asked," she said, a noticeable edge in her voice. "I asked why my father shot him."
He sighed. She could have found gainful employment with the Spanish Inquisition, he thought ruefully. No chance of escape or evasion.
I understand that his lordship, apprehending that the newborn infant was in fact not of his blood, intended to expunge the stain upon his honour by dropping the child out of the window onto the slates in the courtyard 30 feet below, he said bluntly.
Her face had paled perceptibly. How did he find out? She demanded. And if Dar was a groom, why was he there? Did the Earl know he was responsible?
She shuddered, plainly envisioning a scene in which Jamie was summoned to the Earl's presence to witness the death of his illegitimate offspring before facing a similar fate himself. John had no difficulty in discerning her imagination. He had envisioned such a scene himself more than once.
An acute choice of words, he replied dryly. Jamie Fraser is responsible for more than any man I know. As to the rest, I have no idea. I know the essentials of what happened because Isabel knew. Her mother was present and presumably told her only the briefest outline of the incident.
Hmm. She kicked a small stone deliberately. It skittered across the packed sand in front of her, ending a few feet away.
And you never asked Dar about it?
The stone lay in his line of march. He kicked it neatly as he walked, rolling it back into her path.
I have never spoken to your father regarding Geneva, Ellesmere, or William himself, save to inform him of my marriage to Isabel, and to assure him that I would fulfil my responsibilities as William's guardian to the best of my ability.
She set her foot on the stone, driving it into the soft sand, and stopped.
You never said anything to him? What did he say to you? She demanded.
Nothing.
He returned her stare.
Why did you marry Isabel?
He sighed, but there was no point in evasion.
In order to take care of William.
The thick red brows nearly touched her hairline.
So you got married in spite of... I mean, you turned your whole life upside down just to take care of Jamie Fraser's illegitimate son? And neither one of you ever talked about it?
No, he said baffled. Of course not.
Slowly the brows came down again, and she shook her head.
Men,
she said cryptically. She glanced back toward the town. The air was calm, and a haze from the chimneys of Wilmington lay heavy above the trees. No roofs showed. It might have been a dragon that lay sleeping on the shore for all that could be seen. The low rumbling noise wasn't a reptilian snore, though. A small but constant stream of people had been passing by the track, headed for the town, and the reverberations of an increasing crowd were clearly audible whenever the wind was right. "It's nearly dark. I have to go back." She turned toward the lane that led into town, and he followed, relieved for the moment, but under no illusion that the Inquisition was over. She had only one more question, though. "When are you going to tell him?" she asked, turning to look at him as she reached the edge of the trees.
"Tell who what?" he replied, startled.
"Him." She frowned at him, irritated. "William, my brother." The irritation faded as she tasted the word. She was still pale, but a sort of excitement had begun to glow beneath her skin. Lord John felt as though he had eaten something that violently disagreed with him. A cold sweat broke out along his jaw, and his guts clenched into fist-like knots. His knees turned to water.
"Are you quite mad?"
He grasped at her arm, as much to keep from stumbling as to prevent her going off.
"I gather he doesn't know who his father really is," she said with a bit of asperity. "Given that you and Dar never talked to each other about it, you probably didn't see any point talking to him either. But he's grown up now. He has a right to know, surely."
Lord John closed his eyes with a low moan. "Are you all right?" she asked. He felt her bending close to inspect him. "You don't look very good."
"Sit."
He sat himself, back to a tree, and pulled her down beside him on the ground. He breathed deeply, keeping his eyes closed while his mind raced.
Surely she was joking.
Surely not, his cynically observant self assured him. She had a marked sense of humour, but it wasn't in evidence at the moment. She couldn't. He couldn't let her. It was inconceivable that she... But how could he stop her? If she wouldn't listen to him, perhaps Jamie or her mother. A hand touched his shoulder. "I'm sorry," she said softly. "I didn't stop to think." Relief filled him. He felt his bowels begin to uncramp and opened his eyes to see her gazing at him with a peculiar sort of limpid sympathy that he didn't understand at all. His bowels promptly convulsed again, making him fear that he was about to suffer an embarrassing attack of flatulence on the spot. His bowels had read her better than he had. "I should have thought," she reproached herself. "I should have known how you'd feel about it. You said it yourself. He's your son. You've raised him all this time. I can see how much you love him. It must make you feel terrible to think of William finding out about Dar, and maybe blaming you for not telling him sooner." Her hand was massaging his collarbone in what he assumed was meant to be a soothing gesture. If that was her intent, the movement had singularly failed. "But," he began. But she had taken his hand in both hers and was squeezing it earnestly, her blue eyes shimmering with tears. "He won't," she assured him. "William would never stop loving you. Believe me, it was the same for me when I found out about Dar. I didn't want to believe it at first. I had a father, and I loved him, and I didn't want another one. But then I met Dar, and it was... he was who he is." She shrugged slightly and lifted one hand to wipe her eyes on the lace at her wrist. "But I haven't forgotten my other father," she said, very softly. "I never will. Never." Touched, despite the general seriousness of the situation, Lord John cleared his throat.
"Yes, well, I'm sure your sentiments do you great credit, my dear. And while I hope that I likewise enjoy William's affectionate regard at present, and will continue to do so in future, that is really not the point I was endeavouring to make."
"It's not?" She looked up, wide-eyed, tears clumping her lashes into dark spikes.
She was really a lovely young woman, and he felt a small twinge of tenderness.
No,
he said, quite gently under the circumstances.
Look, my love, I told you who William is, or who he thinks he is.
Viscount Whatnot, you mean?
He sighed deeply.
Quite. The five people who know of his true parentage have expended considerable effort for the last 18 years, to the end that no one, William included, should ever have cause to doubt that he is the 9th Earl of Ellesmere.
She looked down at that, her thick brows knitted, lips compressed.
Christ! He hoped that her husband had succeeded in locating Jamie Fraser in time. Jamie Fraser was the only person who had a hope of being more effectually stubborn than his daughter.
You don't understand, she said finally.
She looked up, and he saw that she had come to some decision. We're leaving, she said abruptly. Roger and I and the children.
Oh, he said cautiously. This might be good news on several counts. Where do you propose to go? Will you remove to England or Scotland? If England or Canada, I have several social connections who might be of...
No, not there. Not anywhere you have connections. She smiled painfully at him, then swallowed before continuing. But you see, we'll be gone. For good. I won't. I don't think I'll ever see you again. That realization had just dawned on her. He saw it on her face. And despite the strength of the pang it gave him, he was deeply moved by her obvious distress at the thought.
I will miss you very much, Brianna, he said gently.
He'd been a soldier most of his life, and then a diplomat. He'd learned to live with separation and absence, with the occasional death of friends left behind. But the notion of never seeing this odd girl again caused him a most unexpected degree of grief. Almost, he thought with surprise, as though she were his own daughter. But he had a son as well, and her next words snapped him back to full alertness.
So you see, she said, leaning toward him with an intentness that he would otherwise have found charming. I have to talk to William and tell him. We'll never have another chance.
Then her face changed, and she put a hand to her bosom.
I have to go, she said abruptly. Amanda, my daughter. She needs to be fed.
And with that, she was up and gone, scurrying across the sand of the racetrack like a storm cloud, leaving the threat of destruction and upheaval in her wake. Chapter 117 Surely justice and mercy shall follow me. July the 10th, 1776 The tide turned from the ebb just before 5 o'clock in the morning. The sky was fully light, a clear, pale colour without clouds, and the mudflats beyond the quay stretched grey and shining, their smoothness marred here and there by weed and stubborn seagrass, sprouting from the mud like clumps of hair. Everyone rose with the dawn. There were plenty of people on the quay to see the small procession go out. Two officers from the Wilmington Committee of Safety, a representative from the Merchants' Association, a minister carrying a Bible, and the prisoner, a tall, wide-shouldered figure walking bareheaded across the stinking mud. Behind them all came a slave carrying the ropes.
I don't want to watch this, Brianna said under her breath.
She was very pale, her arms folded over her middle as though she had a stomachache.
Let's go then.
Roger took her arm, but she pulled back.
No, I have to.
She dropped her arms and stood straight, watching. People around them were jostling for the better view, jeering and catcalling so loudly that whatever was said out there was inaudible. It didn't take long. The slave, a big man, grabbed the mooring post and shook it, testing for steadfastness, then stood back while the two officers backed Stephen Bonnet up to the stake and wrapped his body with rope from chest to knees. The bastard wasn't going anywhere.
Roger thought he should be searching his heart for compassion, praying for the man. He couldn't. Tried to ask forgiveness, and couldn't do that either. Something like a ball of worms churned in his belly. He felt as though he were himself tied to a stake, waiting to drown. The black-coated minister leaned close, his hair whipping in the early morning breeze, mouth moving. Roger didn't think that Bonnet made any reply, but couldn't tell for sure. After a few moments, the men doffed their hats, stood while the minister prayed, then put them on again, and headed back toward shore, their boots squelching, ankle-deep in the sandy mud. The moment the officials had disappeared, a stream of people poured out onto the mud, sightseers, hopping children, and a man with a notebook and pencil, who Roger recognised as Amos Krupp, the current proprietor of the Wilmington Gazette.
"Well, that'll be a scoop, won't it?" Roger muttered.
No doubt what Bonnet actually said, or didn't, there would undoubtedly be a broadsheet hawked through the streets tomorrow, containing either a lurid confession or mawkish reports of remorse. Perhaps both.
"Okay, I really can't watch this." Abruptly, Brianna turned, taking his arm. She made it past the row of warehouses before turning abruptly to him, burying her face in his chest and bursting into tears.
"Shh, it's okay. It's going to be all right."
He patted her, trying to infuse some conviction into the words, but his own throat had a lump in it the size of a lemon. He finally took her by the shoulders and held her away from him so that he could look into her eyes.
"You don't have to do it," he said.
She stopped crying and sniffed, wiping her nose on her sleeve like Jemmy, but wouldn't meet his eyes. "I'm okay. It's not even him. It's just everything. Mandy." Her voice wavered on the word. "And meeting my brother. Oh, Roger, if I can't tell him, he'll never know, and I'll never see him or Lord John again, or Mama." Fresh tears overwhelmed her, welling up in her eyes, but she gulped and swallowed, forcing them back. "It's not him," she said, in a choked, exhausted voice.
"Maybe it's not," he said softly, "but you still don't have to do it."
His stomach still churned, and his hands felt shaky, but resolution filled him.
"I should have killed him on Ocracoke," she said, closing her eyes and brushing back strands of loosened hair.
The sun was higher now and bright. "I was a coward. I thought it would be easier to let the law do it." She opened her eyes and now did meet his gaze, her eyes reddened but clear. "I can't let it happen this way, even if I hadn't given my word." Roger understood that. He felt the terror of the tide coming in, that inexorable creep of water rising in his bones. It would be nearly 9 hours before the water reached Bonnet's chin. He was a tall man.
"I'll do it," he said very firmly.
She made a small attempt at a smile, but abandoned it.
"No," she said. "You won't."
She looked and sounded absolutely drained. Neither of them had slept much the night before. But she also sounded determined, and he recognised Jamie Fraser's stubborn blood.
"Well, what the hell? He had some of that blood, too." "I told you," he said, "what your father said that time. It is myself who kills for her. If it has to be done," and he was obliged to agree with her, he couldn't stand it either, "then I'll do it."
She was getting a grip on herself. She wiped her face with a fold of her skirt and took a deep breath before meeting his eyes again. Hers were deep and vivid blue, much darker than the sky.
"You told me. And you told me why he said that, too. What he said to Archbug.
There is a vow upon her.
She's a doctor. She doesn't kill people."
"The hell she doesn't," Roger thought, but better judgment prevented his saying so.
Before he could think of something more tactful, she went on, placing her hands flat on his chest.
"You have one, too," she said.
That stopped him cold.
"No, I haven't."
"Oh, yes, you do."
She was quietly emphatic.
"Maybe it isn't official yet, but it doesn't need to be. Maybe it doesn't even have words, the vow that you took. But you did it, and I know it."
He couldn't deny it, and was moved that she did know it.
"I will."
He put his hands over hers, clasping her long, strong fingers.
"And I made one to you, too, when I told you.
I said
I would never put God before my love for you."
Love? He couldn't believe that he was discussing such a thing in terms of love. And yet, he had the queerest feeling that that was exactly how she saw it.
"I don't have that sort of vow," she said firmly, and pulled her hands out of his. "And I gave my word."
She had gone with Jamie after dark the night before to the place where the pirate was being held. Roger had no idea what sort of bribery or force of personality had been employed, but they had been admitted. Jamie had brought her back to their room very late, white-faced, with a sheaf of papers that she handed over to her father. Affidavits, she'd said. Sworn statements of Stephen Bonnet's business dealings with various merchants up and down the coast. Roger had given Jamie a murderous look, and got the same back, with interest. "This is war," Fraser's narrowed eyes had said, "and I will use any weapon I can." But all he had said was, "Good night then, Anian," and touched her hair with tenderness before departing. Brianna had sat down with Mandy, and nursed her, eyes closed, refusing to speak. After a time, her face eased from its white, strained lines, and she burped the baby and laid her sleeping in her basket. Then she came to bed and made love to him with a silent fierceness that surprised him, but not as much as she surprised him now.
"And there's one other thing," she said, sober and slightly sad. "I'm the only person in the world for whom this isn't murder."
With that, she turned and walked away fast toward the inn where Mandy waited to be fed. Out on the mudflats, he could still hear the sound of excited voices, raucous as gulls. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon, Roger helped his wife into a small rowboat, tied to the quay near the row of warehouses. The tide had been coming in all day. The water was more than 5 feet deep. Out in the midst of the shining grey stood the cluster of mooring posts, and the small dark head of the pirate. Brianna was remote as a pagan statue, her face expressionless. She lifted her skirts to step into the boat and sat down, the weight in her pocket clunking against the wooden slat as she did so. Roger took up the oars and rowed, heading toward the posts. They would arouse no particular interest. Boats had been going out ever since noon, carrying sightseers who wished to look upon the condemned man's face, shout taunts, or clip a strand of his hair for a souvenir. He couldn't see where he was going. Brianna directed him left or right with a silent tilt of her head. She could see. She sat straight and tall, her right hand hidden in her skirt. Then she lifted her left hand suddenly, and Roger lay on the oars, digging with one to slew the tiny craft around. Bonnet's lips were cracked, his face chapped and crusted with salt, his lids so reddened that he could barely open his eyes. But his head lifted as they drew near, and Roger saw a man ravished, helpless, and dreading a coming embrace so much that he half welcomes its seductive touch, yielding his flesh to cold fingers and the overwhelming kiss that steals his breath.
"You have left it late enough, darling," he said to Brianna,
and the cracked lips parted in a grin that split them and left blood on his teeth.
"I knew you'd come, though."
Roger paddled with one oar, working the boat close, then closer. He was looking over his shoulder when Brianna drew the gilt-handled pistol from her pocket and put the barrel to Stephen Bonnet's ear.
"Go with God, Stephen," she said clearly, in Gaelic,
and pulled the trigger. Then she dropped the gun into the water and turned round to face her husband.
"Take us home," she said.
Chapter 118. Regret. Lord John stepped into his room at the inn and was surprised, astonished in fact, to discover that he had a visitor.
"John?"
Jamie Fraser turned from the window and gave him a small smile.
"Jamie?"
He returned it, trying to control the sudden sense of elation he felt. He had used Jamie Fraser's Christian name perhaps 3 times in the last 25 years. The intimacy of it was exhilarating, but he mustn't let it show.
"Will I order us refreshment?"
he asked politely. Jamie hadn't moved from the window. He glanced out, then back at John, and shook his head, still smiling faintly.
"I thank you, no. We are enemies, are we not? We find ourselves regrettably upon opposing sides of what I trust will be a short-lived conflict," Lord John corrected.
Fraser looked down at him, with an odd, regretful sort of expression.
"Not short," he said, "but regrettable, aye?"
"Indeed." Lord John cleared his throat and moved to the window, careful not to brush against his visitor. He looked out and saw the likely reason for Fraser's visit.
"Ah," he said, seeing Brianna Fraser Mackenzie on the wooden sidewalk below.
"Oh," he said, in a different tone, for William Clarence Henry George Ransom, 9th Earl of Ellesmere, had just come out of the inn and bowed to her.
"Sweet Jesus," he said, apprehension making his scalp prickle. "Will she tell him?"
Fraser shook his head, his eyes on the 2 young people below.
"She will not," he said quietly. "She gave me her word."
Relief coursed through his veins like water.
"Thank you," he said.
Fraser shrugged slightly, dismissing it.
It was, after all, what he desired as well, or so Lord John assumed.
The 2 of them were talking together. William said something and Brianna laughed, throwing back her hair. Jamie watched in fascination.
Dear God, they were alike. The small tricks of expression, of posture, of gesture. It must be apparent to the most casual observer.
In fact, he saw a couple pass them, and the woman smile, pleased at the sight of the handsome matched pair.
"She will not tell him," Lord John repeated, somewhat dismayed by the sight. "But she displays herself to him. Will he not?" "But no, I don't suppose he will."
"I hope not," Jamie said, eyes still fixed on them.
"But if he does, he still will not know. And she insisted she must see him once more. That was the price of her silence."
John nodded, silent. Brianna's husband was coming now, their little boy held by one hand, his hair as vivid as his mother's in the bright summer sun. He held a baby in the crook of his arm. Brianna took it from him, turning back the blanket to display the child to William, who inspected it with every indication of politeness. He realized suddenly that every fragment of Fraser's being was focused on the scene outside. Of course, he hadn't seen Willie since the boy was 12. And to see the 2 together, his daughter and the son he could never speak to or acknowledge. He would have touched Fraser, put a hand on his arm in sympathy, but, knowing the probable effect of his touch, forbore to do it.
"I have come," Fraser said suddenly, "to ask a favour of you." "I am your servant, sir,"
Lord John said, terribly pleased but taking refuge in formality.
"Not for myself," Fraser said with a glance at him. "For Brianna." "My pleasure will be the greater," John assured him. "I am exceeding fond of your daughter, her temperamental resemblance to her sire notwithstanding."
The corner of Fraser's mouth lifted, and he returned his gaze to the scene below.
"Indeed," he said. "Well, then, I cannot tell you why I require this, but I need a jewel."
"A jewel?" Lord John's voice sounded blank even to his own ears.
"What sort of jewel?"
"Any sort," Fraser shrugged, impatient.
"It does not matter, so long as it should be some precious gem. I once gave you such a stone."
His mouth twitched at that. He had handed over the stone, a sapphire, under duress as a prisoner of the crown.
though I didn't suppose you'd have that by you still.
In point of fact, he did. That particular sapphire had travelled with him for the last 25 years, and was, at this moment, in the pocket of his waistcoat. He glanced at his left hand, which bore a broad gold band set with a brilliant faceted sapphire, Hector's ring, given to him by his first lover at the age of 16. Hector had died at Culloden, the day after John had met James Fraser, in the dark of a Scottish mountain pass. Without hesitation, but with some difficulty, the ring had been worn a long time and had sunk a little way into the flesh of his finger, he twisted it off and dropped it into Jamie's hand. Fraser's brows rose in astonishment.
"This? Are you sure? Take it."
He reached out then and closed Jamie's fingers around it with his own. The contact was fleeting, but his hand tingled, and he closed his own fist, hoping to keep the sensation.
"Thank you," Jamie said again, quietly. "It is my very great pleasure."
The party below was breaking up. Brianna was taking her leave, the baby held in her arms, her husband and son already halfway down the walk. William bowed, hat off, the shape of his chestnut head so perfectly echoing that of the red. Suddenly Lord John couldn't bear to see them part. He wished to keep that too, the sight of them together. He closed his eyes and stood, hands on the sill, feeling the movement of the breeze past his face. Something touched his shoulder very briefly, and he felt a sense of movement in the air beside him. When he opened his eyes again, all three of them were gone. Chapter 119. Loath to Part. September 1776. Roger was laying the last of the water pipes when Aidan and Jemmy popped up beside him, sudden as a pair of jack-in-the-boxes.
"Daddy! Daddy! Bobby's here!"
"What, Bobby Higgins?"
Roger straightened up, feeling his back muscles protest, and looked toward the big house but saw no sign of a horse.
"Where is he?"
"He went up to the graveyard," Aidan said, looking important. "Do you think he's gone to look for the ghost?"
"I doubt it," Roger said calmly. "What ghost?"
"Malva Christie's," Aidan said promptly. "She walks. Everybody says so."
He spoke bravely but wrapped his arms about himself. Jemmy, who plainly hadn't heard that bit of news before, looked wide-eyed.
"Why does she walk? Where's she going?" "Because she was murdered, silly," Aidan said. "Folk that are murdered always walk. They're looking for the one who killed them."
"Nonsense," Roger said firmly, seeing the uneasy look on Jemmy's face.
Jem had known Malva Christie was dead, of course. He'd gone to her funeral, along with all the other children on the ridge. But he and Brianna had simply told the boy that Malva had died, not that she'd been murdered.
Well, Roger thought grimly, little hope of keeping something like that secret.
He hoped Jem wouldn't have nightmares.
"Malva's not walking about looking for anyone," he said, with as much conviction as he could infuse into his voice. "Her soul is in heaven with Jesus, where she's happy and peaceful. And her body? Well, when people die, they don't need their bodies any more. And so we bury them, and there they stay, all tidy in their graves, until the last day."
Aidan looked patently unconvinced by this.
"Joey McLaughlin saw her 2 weeks ago Friday," he said, bobbing up and down on his toes. "A flitting through the wood," he said, "all dressed in black, and howling most mournful."
Jemmy was beginning to look truly upset. Roger laid down the spade and picked Jem up in his arms.
"I expect Joey McLaughlin was a bit the worse for a dram too much," he said.
Both boys were entirely familiar with the concept of drunkenness.
"If it was flitting through the wood howling, it was most likely Rollo he saw. Come on, though. We'll go find Bobby, and you'll see Malva's grave for yourselves."
He put out a hand to Aidan, who took it happily, and chattered like a magpie all the way up the hill.
And what was Aidan going to do when he left, he wondered.
The idea of leaving, at first so abrupt as to seem completely unreal, unthinkable, had been filtering into his consciousness day by day. As he worked at the chores, dug the trenches for Brianna's water pipes, carried hay, chopped wood, he would try to think, not much longer. And yet it seemed impossible that one day he wouldn't be on the ridge, wouldn't push open the door to the cabin and find Brianna involved in some fiendish experiment on the kitchen table, Jem and Aidan madly rooming round her feet. The feeling of unreality was even more pronounced when he preached of a Sunday, or went round as a minister, if yet without portfolio, to visit the sick or counsel the troubled. Looking into all those faces, attentive, excited, bored, dour, or preoccupied, he simply couldn't believe that he meant to go, callously to abandon them all. How would he tell them, he wondered, with a sort of anguish at the thought. Especially the ones he felt most responsible for.